Shelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
April 4, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. Anyway, it is a Monday, a moon day. It's the first broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect. But, you know, we already started the week with Bob Wilson's show on Sunday. So, what are you going to do? Look, I got a guest tonight, which... I don't know, man. He might not be in a super great mood, but I got introduced to this guy secondhand through J.G. Michael. Want to give a shout-out to him right away. Parallax Views Podcast, of course, the co-host of the Failed State Update. And, man, I love it. J.G. started telling me about this guy off air, and I said, oh, I got to talk to this guy. You kidding me? I had not heard of him before. And maybe many of you have not either. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play an excerpt before I even ask him how he's doing. I'm going to play an excerpt, which is a long excerpt, from this 3 minutes. It timed out to 3 minutes and 33 seconds when I ripped the recording of it. But I cut it down to about 2 minutes. And it's for relevance. I want you to listen very closely to this. And imagine that you're on YouTube or whatever. Like, I don't watch TV, but when you used to watch TV, you used to get these, you know, commercials at night. You know, when I used to watch it, but nowadays, yeah, I'm falling asleep to YouTube in the middle of the night and, you know, watching documentaries and such, and they cram all kinds of weird commercials at you. I wish that I was A, living in Pennsylvania, and B, falling asleep one night and caught this commercial earlier on in life, because it might have been real helpful. I know the time, we'd have to do a time warp in order to get there and all that, but just take a listen to, the audio that I scraped out of this guy's ad. And there is a visual element to it. I'll give you a link in the show notes and all that at the end of the podcast, because I know a lot of you are going to catch this by a podcast. You'll have a link to the original video as best I can find it, and a few other things to follow up on the guest. So there's more to this than what I'm about to play you, but enjoy.
Consequences. They sure suck, don't they? America was built on freedom, not on a bunch of people with more money than you telling you what you can and can't do with all their stupid laws. Laws are arbitrary. Hi, my name is Daniel Music, and I'm a criminal defense attorney based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I stand ready, willing, able, and committed to defend you on all manner of criminal charges, including murder, arson, burglary, bank robbery, simple and aggravated assault, and possibly even funny throwback crimes such as moonshining or pickpocketing. When you're charged with a serious criminal offense, you're facing the fight of your life. You need a lawyer who understands you and understands where you're coming from. Trust me, I may have a law degree, but I think like a criminal. Street knowledge. A lot of criminal defense attorneys around town are going to take your money and then blow you off. That's not me. I pick up the phone, I answer calls, I return letters, and I make jail visits. Because I'll probably be there visiting my friends anyways. I'm the Pittsburgh criminal defense attorney Pittsburgh criminals hire when they commit crimes. Any criminal defense attorney who promises you a result is most likely a liar or a scumbag. But what I can promise you is my committed fighting effort to ensure that you are adequately defended on any charge that you're facing. Pay me now. Thank me later. And remember, you keep your trap shut, and I'll keep your trap open.
Did I mention I'm Jewish?
Daniel Music is licensed to practice law in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania only. All participants in the commercial are actors, and their participation should not be construed as an endorsement. No results are or can be promised by Daniel Music. Any actors who may have committed the crimes they portrayed did so without the knowledge or consent of Daniel Music. This advertisement should be considered a satire and entertainment. No actual crimes were committed in the making of this ad. All weapons and drugs were props and all facsimiles.
That is, first of all, hilarious on multiple levels, but just genius as far as I'm concerned. and that's only part of it. Again, folks, there is a whole visual element to it. At the beginning, it wouldn't have made sense to play the audio, but there's a bunch of actors who appear to be committing a certain criminal acts, and they are thanking Dan and all that at the beginning. It's a whole thing, man. You got to see it. and definitely going to give you the link in the show notes. But let's get right to it. Daniel, first of all, you are a Jew. That's great. I found that to be the one of the biggest punchlines in there because, listen, let's be honest. even if you're not kind of racist in America, a lot of times you're racialist. And that means, you know what, I want a good accountant. I want a good lawyer. That's points right there you got just for being Jewish. Very much like if somebody, you know, has a problem and, you know, they want to hide a body, they might call a guy like me because I got a vowel at the end of my name. I'm just saying, it's one of those things that is hilarious. You're poking fun at yourself, and you were speaking truth in that ad. And anybody else getting a Better Call Saul vibe here? It's anyway, enough out of me. Daniel Music, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I have been better, Chuck, to be completely honest and total candor. I mean, I'm trying as best I can to maintain, but, you know, it's a grim time. You know, it's tick-tock. I'll be in federal prison in a month or so.
Right.
So, you know, it's not... It's a really horrible, you know, it's honestly the worst time of my life. And what's really scary is that it's about to get worse. You know, yeah, I'm about to out of the frying pan into the proverbial fire.
Yeah, I see that. And look, I'm trying to keep it light, brother, because what else can I do for you? I wish I could do things for you because, you know, first of all, whether people like it or not, guys like you are absolutely necessary. I'm not even going to get first into the story about why you're going to prison, because I'd rather let you tell the story about how it is you got to making that commercial and what it is you were actually doing, and let you tell your own story, if you don't mind. And obviously, we've already given the spoiler to everybody that, yeah, it's not too long from now that you'll be going to prison. But, you know... One of the things that that I understand about why it is you're going to prison is one of the most ridiculous things in existence to begin with. You know, it's got a little something to do with cannabis, folks. You know, and it shouldn't even be. But what did Will Smith's wife call it? Entanglements, right? It shouldn't be an entanglement that that you should even have to be considering, or anybody else should, because it's a plant. And you know, I know everybody uses the word marijuana. I don't. I call it cannabis because that's what it is. But anyway, let's not go there just yet. Let's tell the happier part of this story, because you graduated law school in what, 2019?
No, I graduated in 2012 and I got barred in 2013, so I could practice by the end of 2013. I got sworn in. I passed the bar at the end of 2012, and I think I officially got sworn in 2013.
Ah, okay. So I've got
so
my...
I shot the commercial at the end of 2013, and I think it went up on YouTube in the very beginning of, like, spring 2014.
Oh, okay. So way earlier, because... all right. So now I got my timeline wrong. All right. So you're talking about 10 years ago when you finished law school. And you got out, you got able to practice pretty much right away. I mean, you got to take the bar and all that. So tell me about this thing. I mean, first of all, I saw you interviewed about it, and I've done a little research on it where you were talking about, you know, utilizing the hip-hop elements, and that's great. That's one thing. You also got some visual stuff going on here, some special effects and things that back at about that time... people had access to, but not everybody knew how to use. You know, today there's so many people, of course, they have the, you know, the suite from Adobe at this point, and they can do all sorts of After Effects and things like that. But your commercial didn't go crazy with that. It was, but it was real slick. It was real cool. And it was meant just for the people in Pennsylvania because, well, if you're licensed to practice in the state, usually, it covers the whole state. And there you go. I mean, tell me about that time, though, when you decided to film this and how it came together. Did you write the script? Did you have friends? What went on here?
So I came up with the idea of it, and I wrote the script. I definitely did it in collaboration with the director, you know, who put it together and made it look that slick and did all the After Effects. I did it because there was the financial collapse in 2008-2009, and that was right when I started law school. So I graduated law school into the most regressive legal marketplace in American history, where literally nobody was getting hired anymore to be an attorney. So I had to hang out my own shingle coming out of law school right off the bat. So I'm in a really, really clogged field with a lot of people who are a lot older than me and have way more experience. So I had really, you know, three options. I could work for free. They weren't even hiring at the public defenders at that point. Like, people were literally working for free at the public defenders for, you know, a year, year and a half before they even got brought on. It was just a really, really grim time. I could apprentice myself out to a lawyer, but that's really hard too, because, you know, those guys kill what they eat as well for criminal defense attorneys. So they aren't really going to have a lot to pay you, and you're not, you know, I did do some of that, but like, you're not really bringing a lot to the table. Or, you know, the last one was I needed to attract customers, and this is like a really closed up game. It's a very, very, it's like, you know, old school insurance sales or something like that. It's all word of mouth. It's not, you know, there is advertising on billboards, but it's mostly for personal injury. Honestly, since my commercial came out in Pittsburgh now, more criminal defense attorneys advertise. I think I expanded the paradigm to some extent. So my only advantages were really that I was a rapper, so I knew how to communicate to a camera and a crowd. I knew how to speak effectively in that manner, and I could come up with creative skits and video ideas. And I had access to that type of production for not a lot of money, because I knew a lot of people who shot rap videos and they had the cameras and whatnot. So it was doable. And then I also had a lot of friends who were criminals, because I was also a criminal, even though I went to law school. So it was really easy for me to get the people together, because those are just my friends anyways. And they all thought it was super funny to get filmed doing that. So we put it together really quickly. We shot it for a couple thousand dollars, edited it in like 6 weeks, and then it just went up on YouTube with no promotion, no monetization. It was pure viral. I put it up on a personal YouTube channel and shared it on my Facebook that had, you know, 1800 friends, and I think it got up to like 2 million views before I pulled it. I pulled it in 2019 when I realized that I was getting federal heat and that there was a good chance I was going to get indicted. I took it off the internet as fast as I could, but it had been downloaded so many times by then, it still lived in some corners, so it in fact did not die.
No, it couldn't have, because, see, that's the problem. Anything you put out there, if somebody gets a hold of it, it's over, because you can't pull it back. It's impossible. You know... some people didn't understand that, and I'm sure you had no idea that it was going to get that big. You were just hoping.
I thought I was going to get 20,000 views, and it would be, you know, it'd be a little tempest in a teapot, small controversy, lightly talked about, but not that it was going to be just. You know, when it first came out, it got national and international coverage. I mean, it really became a thing for a while. I definitely got 15 minutes of fame off of it. I had the opportunity at that point. If I had been smart, I would have just immediately gone on to become a Twitter and Instagram celebrity, because then I wouldn't have had to have practiced law anyways. And this was early on in the game for those mediums, so I could have accrued a bunch of followers and monetized it. But to be honest, I really wasn't that slick. Even though I made a viral commercial, I myself wasn't quote-unquote good at the internet. So I didn't understand the monetization of it. And I was also juggling a lot of balls, because I was trying to be a lawyer. I was also selling a lot of weed, too. And then I didn't want to sell weed anymore. So then all of a sudden becoming like a reality star and signing a deal where there would be cameras in my apartment, where I'd have like 100 pounds stacked up, and I had all my suits like laid out to go to court the next day. Yeah, it just didn't seem like a good idea.
Well, right.
So maybe that was one of the only cautionary decisions I made, because – I was already burning the candle at both ends. At that point, it would have been the proverbial cross joint, right? You know, it would have burnt all down to the middle pretty quickly.
Right.
I left the profession really quickly, because I realized I was just this, you know, human prejudice to my clients. That so many people hated the video that there was just no way that I was going to be able to effectively represent people. You know, it made my experiences really unpleasant in court, and then that also, you know, I genuinely cared about my clients and I wanted to help them out. So the last thing I wanted was to create an even more adverse environment for them than they were already in as a criminal defendant in American court, which is already one of the worst things you could be in history.
Right.
So I backtracked out almost as quickly as I came in, and then I just went right back to what I knew, which was selling weed. And, serendipitously, fortuitously at that point, the business really exploded in that time, and I put all my time and energy into that and kind of just became like the pot, like mob boss of Western PA, where I just had a stranglehold on the trade for the region.
Well, you can't put it any more bluntly than that. Again, cannabis to me, it's absolutely ridiculous that this even needs to be in a black market. You know what I mean? I don't get it. I mean, I'm against all drug prohibition. I think it's all absolutely ridiculous. And it's not a war on drugs. It's a war on people, and mostly poor people, period. And that's all there is to it. But same time, look, you got an opportunity there. You know how to do that. So you did it. I can imagine that you might have been able to create a franchise out of yourself where your name didn't have to go forward in one world, but it could have went forward in another, and you might have been able to split it. You know what I mean? Business-wise, get a couple of guys under you, and you probably could have sort of farmed out the legal business if you had some guys that were like-minded with you.
I think the problem with being a lawyer, and this does happen in certain legal businesses, but the problem with being a criminal defense attorney is it's not like being a personal injury attorney. There are criminal defense attorneys with, small firms where they have like 4, 5, 6, 7 people working for them.
Right.
But it's not like personal injury firms where you can have this one giant personality and then you farm it out to other people. For criminal defense stuff, most of the time, they want it to be you. It's really hard. It's a hard job because there's only one you. And then also, it's mostly flat rate. So, you might charge a giant price at the door, but then how much of it are you actually going to get paid? The economics of it are horrific. I mean, honestly, the economics of selling marijuana or cannabis in the late stage illegal game that I was in was also horrific because it was a large marketplace, but it was extremely regressive.
Right.
But selling cannabis was made a lot more sense than being a criminal defense attorney. I mean, that shit was nutty. By the time I got into it, even it was such a choked game, at least in Pittsburgh. Hence my need to make the commercial. If I could have come out of law school and not gotten rich, but just garnered a living wage on my own as a lawyer in previous times would have in the 70s, 80s, 90s, even early aughts, what have you, then I would have done so. For sure. I mean, even if I didn't love it, I'm a grown man, people do stuff they don't like to do all the time.
Right.
But it was like, so I had one thing that I got too famous at too quickly that wasn't ever really going to make that much sense for me. And then I had this other thing that I'd done really well anytime I'd ever done it since I was 13, no matter how many times I walked away. And it was almost just beckoning me. So at a certain point in your life, right, you kind of just have to put stuff away and just do. You either have to commit to the fact that you're never going to do what you want to do, or you have to go all the fuck out and just do whatever you want to do. And that's what I did.
Right.
I'd already been in it many a time. I'd been in it neck deep, and then I climbed out, neck deep, climbed out. That last time, I went all the way off the deep end and was like, whatever happens, happens. I'm going to do this now.
Yeah, see, I've tried to explain this to people where, I mean, look, frankly, I'll admit to you what they can't possibly prosecute me on now, which is that, as a little kid, I was exposed to a lot of the heroin business and cocaine, too. And, look, weed was just barely even a thing because it wasn't as profitable in New York and New Jersey, okay? If you could do it in large quantities, you could do okay, but honestly, I was taught how to cut things, mix things, and everything else, and where to get and how to do the math, so to speak, all the way around when I was young. I mean, I had Freeway Ricky Ross on the show, and we talked about when crack basically emerged and how it just suddenly had urban chemists who knew how to teach us how to do this and things like that. And I got out of all that at a certain point, and then later in life, you know what? Things twisted and turned. Right about the time that you're talking about, as a matter of fact, after that housing crisis hit, you know what? It was time to not get myself thrown in jail for child support. Had to generate money. And I knew how to. And it turns out that it was easier to sell, well, you didn't have to go get bags of dope anymore. Now all you had to do was find prescription pills. So I was able to do that and not make a big living, but survive. It was because it was what I knew. And I get it. So, I mean, I'm just telling you from my personal end. I'm not trying to tell you my whole personal story, but I'm just saying I get what you're saying. And here's the thing. Guys like this who are doing this kind of thing, frankly, yeah, you wind up needing a lawyer now and then. Now, I didn't because, again, I kept it small, you know. But you get temptations where you can go larger, you know, and you go large enough, you're going to get somebody's attention. And you already had a spotlight on you from a viral video. You're already pissing off. Like, I can imagine that you walked into courtrooms trying to handle clients. And like you were saying, it was making it more hostile because guaranteed you heard from a bench more than once, oh, I've seen you. And
definitely. You know, I got held in contempt before. When the judge gave me the contempt speech, it wasn't about anything I had done. It was literally about the commercial, and that was honestly the turning point. That's when I knew in my mind that I could never really come back into the courtroom again, that I was just doing myself and other people a disservice. So I walked away from whatever notoriety was in the commercial. Honestly, like, me going to law school and becoming a lawyer was really aberrant. I know that for the rest of my life, it's literally the only fucking thing people are ever going to want to talk about is that I was a lawyer and that I made the commercial. But really, the thing that I did most consistently was I was a Jewish weed dealer around other Jews in, like, large-scale ethnic organized marijuana dealing syndicates. From when I was a little kid, I watched the older guys do it in my neighborhood and make a shit ton of money because it's an urban neighborhood, whether it's upscale or not. Right. Like, just if you controlled the pot trade in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, you would make a shit ton of money. Same deal.
Right.
And then I did it in college, same deal, with a bunch of other tough, crazy, mostly Jewish guys who taught me how to do it large scale and make a lot of money. And then I picked it back up in Pittsburgh, and by that point, the guys who had run the situation before me when I was a kid that I watched growing up, they had all caught large-scale federal prison sentences themselves, and they were gone. So there was a power vacuum when I came back, and I kind of ignored it for a while and just did what you said, subsistence, to get myself through law school. Mm-hmm. But then I was just so tired of ignoring what I was really good at, because that's what I was really, really good at. I was really good at that, and it rewarded me. I've been good at a lot of other things in my life, but in the end, they just become glorified hobbies, because in America, you're an economic unit. You're not really a human being with a soul. So if you're good at something, it better be remunerative. Otherwise, it's not really worth doing, right?
That is the most concise way I've ever heard that statement put, and it's absolutely accurate. Because you can be very good at a lot of things, but unless it is something that is financially consistently providing for you, guess what? Like you said, it becomes a glorified hobby. And we now live in a strange land where, you know, the gig economy and everything else comes together to just make it incrementally worse, honestly, than it used to be.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. I was raised as a child of privilege. I don't make any bones about that. I was a weird anomaly because I was incredibly precocious and streetwise and aggressive and crazy, but I was also a child of privilege. I was just one of those crazy rich kids that would be running around the city with a bunch of other kids that grew up way tougher than I did, but I fit in 100% because I was just as nuts as they were. That was my bag. Gotcha. 100%, because the streets are a meritocracy. And if you're, you know, and before we weren't committing crimes for profit, it was, you know, stuff like vandalism and like graffiti and like little burglaries and fighting people and stuff like that, you know, typical city kid shit.
Right.
And, you know, if you prove your mettle at that, it's basically the underground, you know, we were all into like breakdancing and freestyling and graffiti and smoking weed at the benches and selling little amounts of weed, just, you know, trying to be feral, tough street kids in that milieu, in that urban milieu. And that's the farm team for large-scale drug dealing.
Well,
you know,
see,
you're 13, 14 doing that. the guys who are 15, 16, 17, they're making a little bit of money. And then the guys in the early 20s who are like the OG dudes who are supplying those guys are making more money than your parents, even if your parents are rich.
Right. See, that's the key thing. And based on an ethnically sort of, let's call it an ethnically dense area. See, because here we go again. I'm just going to turn to my own story. I'm half Italian, right? But that was good enough to get work. And how did I get work? It was because I was a kid that showed I could do these other things, no problem. And you get kind of picked out of the choir. There's a whole bunch of you, maybe doing what you're doing. But it's like, wait a minute, that kid actually kept his mouth shut when this happened, this kind of thing. You get noticed. And when you get noticed, the guys who are further along than you take you along. And this is the way it works. So again,
I tell people all the time, I held a lot of umbrellas in the rain in my late teens and early 20s before I even made a penny. I was just rolling around with the guys, in Philadelphia when I went to college and I was really learning the trade. I wasn't getting paid or making sales for a long time. I'd literally just roll around with the guy. He was like a friend. He was my older brother. You know, I loved him. And he was a crazy motherfucker, and he lived this incredible lifestyle. He had a loft in Chinatown above a mafia-run strip club, and he knew everybody. He knew the Russians. He knew the Italian-made guys. Right. He knew the black gangsters. He knew the Cambodians and the Vietnamese. He knew the Puerto Ricans. And it was like real-life Grand Theft Auto. And he'd scoop me up in an $80,000 car every day. We'd roll around eating really expensive Chinese food in Chinatown or going to Russian restaurants and meeting with Russian mobsters. And I was literally just there, just tagging along with him, watching the science of how he did things and how he conducted business. And because I had no financial interest, whereas everyone else around him was always angling to get weed first or get it at a cheaper price or get the best part of the load, I was just his homie, and I was also Jewish, and he taught me pretty much everything. Right. And then validated me with a lot of the contacts I needed when I wanted to get started. And so when I did start, I took off like a rocket. It was, I started in my mid-20s. Most guys, like, again, I had done it, but really started in earnest. Like, started grabbing. Well, first I got like 5/8 of an ounce, but when I started working up to pounds and stuff like that in my, my mid-20s, I took off very quickly, and I was able to do it very efficiently because I had already put in an insane amount of time learning the game, to the point where I was the most well-coached rookie, and I had been picked out of the choir, and I had been validated and co-signed by all these people. So in that small fraternity, ethnically, which, there's less of us than there are of Italians or other ethnicities doing it, I already had the co-sign. Anytime I went somewhere or met somebody from another city who was Jewish, odds are I could refer them back to these guys or the people in Squirrel Hill, and I was stamped. It was all good.
Yeah, no, I experienced the same. Again, I'm in Jersey, right, as a kid, and it was like New York, Philly, they were fine with me when I, because it was already known, it was fine. And I'm not saying I was in, but I had enough that if I needed to deal with somebody, it wasn't like they were patting me down, It was like, no, this one, he's been around. It's all right.
Yeah.
And you get that.
Yeah, and the thing that people got to realize, too, is that these stories ebb and flow. Like, you'll go years without seeing someone from your past who's tight with you or you were tight with just because people part ways, not even under acrimony. I moved to a different city. I basically fled Philly because shit was hot there. My then-fiancé at the time was now my wife, and I went to Pittsburgh. Again, I tried to quit again, went to law school, tried to go legit, get a straight job, got into law school, went through law school, and I was selling a little bit. I was, subsistence. I was selling cuts in quarters and stuff like that in law school just to get by and supplement a student lifestyle so that I could live better, my wife could live better. But then when I wanted to pick things up, there was always someone I could reach out. Italians, they call themselves, paesan or compare, whatever.
Right.
In Jews, it's landsman. you know, my landsman. So there was always a landsman I could reach out to if I wanted to bump things up a level. But it's hard to do. You know, it's not like a movie where, you know, in a movie, everything's very product-centric. For Weed, it's not product-centric. I mean, good product is important. But the most important thing for Weed, as you said, because Weed is the hardest thing to make money off of, you actually need a shit ton of customers. And they're the hardest customers to get because even in your day, in the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, people had a multiplicity of options, and that's even more so 10 years ago. And now it's to the point where the game's basically dead or it's on its last legs.
Right.
So just getting product wasn't enough. You needed to have you need to accrue customers. And that's where I opened up the underground dispensary because I saw, you know, Pittsburgh's a small town, and again, it's very ethnic. You know, there's a Greek neighborhood, a Polish neighborhood, Irish neighborhood, Italian neighborhood, Jewish neighborhoods, a few black neighborhoods. It's very, very Slovak neighborhoods. It's very, very regimented and segmented into these 93 different neighborhoods. So everyone, every neighborhood had a guy that got 20 pounds, 30 pounds, 50 pounds, 100 pounds, whatever. And nobody, yeah, I'd been gone. I'd been going away in Philly for a long time doing my thing, and I kind of had to pick up and come home. So when I wanted to pick it back up in Pittsburgh, I knew I couldn't just step in and interrupt that stuff. Cosign or no cosign, unless I could beat their numbers significantly, I wasn't just going to walk in and, you know, and turn the town over under my thumb. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's a stupid fantasy. It's some movie shit.
Yeah,
so I actually had to work really hard at it, and I started literally from the absolute bottom up, selling grams and cuts and quarters in my hallway, just trapping, and I built up this really, really bulky customer base of small customers, which enabled me to make an exceptional profit margin, which I then continued to reinvest, which allowed me to get more pounds, which allowed me to drop my number per pound, which increased my dividends per pound. And I wasn't even really doing wholesale. I would buy like 200 pounds at a time of super high-end shit and just stash it somewhere and literally just sell it myself, busting down 1 pound after another into 128/8, just standing in my hallway 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then when my crazy downstairs neighbor, Dale, the ex-left-wing terrorist, you know, Big Lebowski-esque former SEAL worker guy, who's in the commercial, actually, and we filmed it, actually, outside of the store, he had the downstairs apartment for me. He was the one that broached the idea of me fronting him, and he had people he could sell it to. And I started leaving small quantities, ounce here, ounce there. I didn't think he knew how much weed I had access to. And then it got to the point where I started sending my customers to him, and that was very organic, and it just morphed into the store. So then the store just was a fully staffed underground dispensary with every type of cannabis product that you can imagine, and I was really good at sourcing it, and I had unlimited access to weed. I mean, I could get more weed than any, you know, than I even knew what to do with at that time. That was never an issue. But with the store, my profits then, you know, doubled, tripled, went up tenfold, twentyfold, fiftyfold, whatever. And now I'm making money like I'm a kingpin, even though I'm not going through that much product. And that enabled me, that gave me a base to kind of go into the upper echelon of people in Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, Western PA. And then I was able to cut my margins on wholesale because a lot of these guys, they were charging 3, 4, 5 points per P, where I could charge next to nothing. I could charge whatever I needed to per P. I could charge 25 cents and make $25 a pound. Because I had this base of economic business coming in from the store that I couldn't really fall below. So it enabled me to flip everybody over to me over a, you know, 3-4 year period of time to the point where I onboarded so many people that, you know, it was just like a whale kind of swapping plankton. And then at a certain point, you know, it got to the point where I looked around and there really wasn't anyone else that was even remotely comparable to what I doing per volume or frequency.
It was like you were the Pittsburgh Walmart of weed, and you just ate up all the little other private.
I could hit you in any way you wanted. You want wholesale? I mean, you know, I can get you a truckload. You want mid wholesale? Cool. I can get you 30, 50, 60, 100 pounds and get you, you know, a little car truckload or van load. You want, you know, you want 10 pounds? That's fine. You want 1 pound every day? That's fine. You want 3 pounds every day? That's fine. You want, or if you want other stuff, like you want cuts, quarters, variety packs, edibles, drinkables, cartridges, wax of all types, you know, shatter, whatever, well, anything, literally any product that you could imagine in any dispensary, legal or illegal, I had it in the store. Or And if you liked it in the store and you wanted to make a bulk inquiry, then you could hit our wholesale department and we could let you know what we could get for you. You'd be like, all right, we were that organized. I was that organized. I could be like, oh, you like this one cart? Okay, like your cousin heard about those. He wants 6,000 of them. All right, well, this is what it costs. Meet us on Thursday.
Right. So you're doing well, right? I mean, you, like I said, look, Walmart, again, it's about quantity. And that's why they turn around. They go, okay, we'll make 2 cents on a thing because we know we're going to sell 20,000. It's not a problem. You know what I mean? That's only one product. And that's what I meant by the Walmart. You know what I mean? Where
Definitely. And I was vertically integrated in my own small fashion because I had the store and I had a separate parallel wholesale business. So a lot of people, when the raid went down and then last year when I got indicted, a lot of people only knew me as the guy who had the pot store, the underground dispensary that shut down mysteriously one day. The dispensary was never raided. Nobody, you know, the dispensary never got hit. And we just shut it down the same day that they hit the wholesale operation because it would be foolish to persist because we knew that they were up to us in some fashion. It would have been, you know, comically irresponsible to continue forward. So I just deaded everything that day and went to ground. But yeah, I was vertically integrated. So I could also, if shit wasn't working out in a wholesale sense, I could dump it through the retail store. So even, you know, it's like if I got like a load of shit that wasn't really like the best, I mean, if it was terrible, I'd return it. But that's a lot, this, you know, when you're in wholesale weed, you contend a lot getting bad loads, especially when you're situated back east because the people from Cali are always trying to fuck you. It's like an endless dance with them back and forth. They're right. Trying to send you shitty product for a higher number, you're trying to get cheaper product for the best number you can, or, you know, high quality, cheaper number. And the marketplace is regressive, so I started to have leverage over them, as did other big people back east in other cities, and even in my own city. So, but when I did get stuff that wasn't it, other guys, they had no way out of that, you know, because if you only sold pounds and you got hit with 300 bad pounds, what are you going to do? I mean, that's going to tie you up. Even if you're selling them at break even, I mean, that is an insane amount of money to have to turn trash into cash. Whereas right. For me, if I got 300 bad pounds, I mean, it's annoying, but I would just wood chipper that shit through the fucking store. I mean, I'd mix it in with other stuff. I would only have bad stuff. But in a few weeks or a month or two or whatever, not only did I have my money back, I had it back at store. So it was like even when I caught a bad break, I still came out better than anyone else could.
Well, because you were dealing in such large quantities. So this is the thing. One wonders, it's working, everything's flowing. You definitely got your own personal end of economic stimulation for your area, because I'm sure you weren't the only one making money here. You had people working for you and people working with you, okay, which is two different things, but still. Seems like, I don't know, you were good for the local economy, brother.
100%. I thought, dude. Endless college tuitions, doctor bills, braces, rents, surgeries, vehicles, loans paid off, mortgages, you name it. You know, like the operation was an economic engine that literally gave dozens of families, so hundreds of people in an economically depressed area of the country, Western Pennsylvania, where there is some nascent gentrification now that's, you know, almost running rampant through the city. But for a lot of the people in the marijuana economy or cannabis economy, that doesn't touch them at all, be they black, white, whatever have you. It gave them a really, really nice standard of living for a protracted period of time. You know, guys that never made more than $25,000, $30,000 a year working their fingers to the bone, they're making a comfortable $300,000 a year. They're 2-3 rounds down from me.
Exactly. And, like, I experienced the same thing again with the way Asbury Park changed. Now it's a totally gentrified area. But if it wasn't for the black market, there wouldn't have been a market. You know what I mean? In Asbury Park when I was a kid. Jersey City kind of goes through these waves, too. Same kind of thing. And you're familiar with these areas a little bit, I'm sure.
So in my run. So my wife's from Princeton.
Okay.
And Asbury are happy places. So we would stay at the Emperor's, and I would just wake up every morning while, you know, and I have like three phones on me. I go light up a giant joint and I would get a coffee, and I'd do the Tony Soprano walk down that part of the boardwalk on Asbury, because that's where the Empress is. And I would just literally sit there at 6, 7, 8 in the morning, sit right as, you know, at sunrise is hitting, and just smoke joints and monitor my phone traffic on all my different burners so I could see what was going on with my business.
Right.
Even though I was in Asbury. So no, I'm familiar with Asbury, and I've seen the economic swing of extreme gentrification. But you can look at the way things are set up there, the way the buildings are, and the old school people who are there, especially the Italians and the Irish, and the people of color. And you can see an era where that place, like you said, if it wasn't for the 3- and 4-digit lottery, sports booking, drug sales, and stolen goods, that was the, and prostitution, that was the only shit that was happening there.
Yeah, once the family vacation spot disappeared, you know, and all the stores left, and all the manufacturing jobs, there were manufacturing jobs there too. Like when I was a baby, there were manufacturing jobs, but it all went away. The underground economy came in, and that's how it functioned. You know, I grew up in that area, so it's exactly that. up and down the Jersey Shore, but I spent a lot of time in, I graduated from Neptune High School, which is a town right next to it, but I lived in Ocean Grove, which is right next door, and Asbury, and that's what you had to do. It was just the way of the world. So, and in the 80s, like I said, again, when crack came through, it didn't destroy the place. It actually fueled a lot of business, you know. And anyway, look, I don't want to delve too deep into that because I want to get into the rest of the story here. You're doing good. Like I said, economic stimulation for a depressed area, which you agree with me on, because, you know, Pittsburgh got hit pretty hard with the housing crisis and all that. So, I mean, you definitely had to have been able to scrape something together there just to survive. Not you, but I mean other people.
Pittsburgh's populated with street guys, just because when you have an area, because there's two Pittsburghs. There's the new Pittsburgh, you know, America's most livable city, the knowledge tech economy, mostly white, because there's also non-white people, but highly educated people moving from other parts of the country because of the meds and eds, you know, university, medical education, healthcare scene, plus the tech scene, all melded together, mostly in the neighborhoods on the east of the city. Crazy gentrification, you know, amazing flip houses, price, you know, rents going up $1,000 per year over year. Right. But then the bulk of the city is still in a, you know, very old demographically, very, very poor, very working class, very regressive, you know, local marketplace for people, for jobs and stuff like that. And that goes all the way out into the tri-quad Sept County area in western PA down to West Virginia and Ohio. So you have a lot of people in the city where, you know, Pittsburgh's a hard city to sell weed because everyone fucking hustles.
Yeah, right.
Because we always used to joke in Pittsburgh that there was $800 that went around the city every day. Like the whole city was, because it was such an old school, you know, local yokel, you know, we call it yinzers, you know, Western Pennsylvania, because they say yins, not yous. Yeah. You know, it was such an old yinzer Appalachian. It's basically an Appalachian city. So you have the Appalachian people by nature are just like really wily, fractious people, and they all have their little factions. They stay in their areas. They're not really great at getting rich, but they're definitely great at like fighting and fucking and been in a good tale and a good song and stuff like that. They're wild people, and everyone had like subsistence street hustles to get by. And it was just, you know, it was a place that was rife with crooks. And again, people get very stereotypical and they don't understand. Pittsburgh is very, very white. It's not that there aren't a lot of black people there too, but compared to other major cities, Pittsburgh's a really white city. There are a lot of really poor white people in Pittsburgh, in the actual inner city, in a way that you wouldn't see in, you know, you would see it in New York in the, again, or even in Jersey in the 70s, early 80s, whatever. You won't see it as much now. You only see it in places maybe like, you know, Kansas City, Little Rock, Arkansas, Boston, parts of Chicago, but it's not as prevalent as you know, it's just not the way it is now. Even poor white people generally tend to live in lower end suburbs, or they live in rural areas, you know, out right. cut in the country. In Pittsburgh, you have both, because there's certainly Western Pennsylvanians that fit that demographic profile. But in Pittsburgh, you just had a lot of guys that got laid off in the steel era. The mills all shut down in the 80s, and the area went into complete economic, almost, you know, holocaust in a few months. It went from being incredibly vibrant, really, really strong working class that actually had upper middle class buying power, to being like, you know, Gary, Indiana level destitute. I mean, that's what all those mill towns outside the city on the rivers look like.
Right.
So there's just a lot of guys that are trying to hustle. So it's on one hand, there's a lot of competition, and it's very fractious. On the other hand, if you could be someone like me that was able to kind of rise above all that and unite everyone together, which is what I was able to do in the limited venue of marijuana sales, you have a lot of people that will work for you and work with you, because there's just a deep pool of people to do it.
Right. So, look, this leads to the ugly question. All right. And how did you get busted? Because it seems to me like you should have had some loyalty from the people that were making money. You weren't, you know, look, you're not doing the harmful thing here that people are generally worried about when it comes to the underground economy. I mean, come on, cannabis, you're not hurting anybody, man. I'm sorry.
I like to compare myself to an old school numbers guy. Again, if you grew up in Asbury Park, it's like those guys, yep. like, because here's the thing, like those guys, they're mobsters, you know, they're organized crime, but they're not, you know, they're not running around shooting people or whatever. They'll defend themselves, and they move in an organized fashion. They're not pussies. They're tough guys, but they're not, you know, they're not out there like torching cars. They're not, you know, running in people's houses and tying them up. They're not shooting people in the street.
No.
You know, it's just not how they roll. Business.
Right.
They got stores. People come in. They voluntarily place their bets. Money gets collected. It's a very organized system, and guys make a lot of money off of doing it. That was what I was the equivalent of. It was literally, but you know, nowadays the new vice was pop. Instead of people wanting to play a number, they can bet, because you could, you know, because that you can do that playing the lottery, or you can do FanDuel off your phone. You know, the vice of the day in Pittsburgh was people wanted to go to these, you know, series of underground apartments that were made to look like pot stores, and people wanted to buy pounds and break them down and sell them on different campuses. So it's the same. That's the stripe of underworld guy I was. You know, like it organized. There's a difference, and you would understand growing up in Asbury. There's a difference between someone who's like a, you know, because mobster means like not dangerous, just means organized, as opposed to a gangster. Like Charles
right.
Manson said, "I'm a gangster, baby. I take money." Well, I never took anyone's money in my life. I did good business with people.
No, see, and that's the thing is I got the first time I got dragged into this situation, I was 6 years old, and it's a weird story, but. A wise guy basically said, took me on as his mascot and taught me exactly what it is you're talking about here, about, you know, the numbers and that kind of collection, and okay, we deal with the local politicians a little bit, this kind of stuff. These were not guys that were menaces to anybody who didn't want to get in business with them. And even then, you're not talking about menaces, you're talking about businessmen who just happen to be dealing in a business that's not acceptable according to the government. You know what I mean? That's it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I was taught. And got to tell you, I know the different levels, and I met plenty of different interesting people. But the truth is that there was a whole slew of those kind of guys that just, you know what, if you didn't even want to know they existed, you didn't have to. Okay? Very simple.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to engage, maybe they had something that you couldn't get, you know, at the Rexall or whatever. You know what I'm saying? So... And it didn't matter if it was cannabis or numbers or, like you said, you know, prostitution, which, again, to me, is one of those things where if you got people going into voluntary agreements, I don't understand why the law is involved. You know, adults make agreements with each other all the time where they exchange things like that. And we usually call it marriage, except it comes with less sex. I mean, the truth is there, and the state took over the lotteries. So, you know, they took that out of the mobster's hands. But frankly, it was probably run better when it was guys walking around and picking the numbers off of the horse races, okay? Thing is that I want to know how it is that a guy like you, who I'm thinking to myself would be protected by a neighborhood, and I saw that happen too, where it's like nobody wants to mess with you because you probably had the sense to do a few good things and make friends and be nice. You know what I mean? Like if you're running business out of an apartment, you make sure that the people that actually have to live near you don't get bothered or hassled. You know what I mean? This kind of stuff you usually take care of if you're going to grow to that size. And I'm
no, 100%. So I mean, and the retail operation ran like that for sure. There was the retail operation was much beloved. Everyone in the neighborhood knew what was up with it. There was no issues whatsoever. We absolutely got looked aside by cops and even some local politicians. Nobody cared because it was a pot store. Everyone smoked weed. Even a lot of cops and politicians smoke weed. So, you know, people needed weed. I mean, why would they shut us down? It would be like shutting down like your only butcher or something. We had something people needed.
Exactly.
The wholesale thing got more tricky because, again, that's when you're really venturing out of, you know, a fun confabulation of a bunch of wacky, colorful characters like Crazy Dale and the other people manning the store. And then you're verging into, you're really getting into organized crime because it's not about the modality, it's about the money.
Right.
And anytime you have that much money coming in and going out, then the people who are coming there, those bonds of trust decay a little bit because you're not, you know, the wholesale operation, which was based in Squirrel Hill, the Jewish neighborhood, the retail operation was based in a bohemian artist neighborhood called Friendship. That was about three neighborhoods over. But the wholesale operation that I put in the middle of Squirrel Hill, because that's where I was comfortable and that's where I like running shit from, because that was my prerogative.
Right.
Those guys, these are all guys who are there to make money. And there are some guys who are extremely loyal, you know, loyal, tough, committed guys. But the thing is that you don't really know, and this is something that, you know, your godfathers of yore from Asbury could have taught you or did teach you maybe too. You don't know what someone's really about until it happens. Until, you know, and you don't know if someone's really tough until the gun comes out. Do they, do they rush the gun or do they sit down blubbering and start crying or do they just stand there and say, what are you going to do? Like, what's the, you know, what are your choices? You don't know who's tough until a fight breaks out. Do you run away or do you just jump in and get pummeled to help your friend even though you have no chance of winning? And you don't know what it is until you get popped. Until you have the cuffs go on and you can't go anywhere and all of a sudden your fun life when you're a privileged weed dealer in your late 20s, early 30s, and, you know, you're used to making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and you go on vacation with your hot girlfriend in Miami, and you're going overseas, and you're chartering private jets, and you're throwing up money in a strip club, and all that stops in 1 second because you're in the back of a squad car, and someone drops all the charges and paperwork on your lap, and they're talking about, you know, they're talking about years. They're not talking about 6 months or probation or whatever. Right. They're talking about 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, 12 years. You don't know what someone's going to do till they're in that position, man, unless they've been there before. That's the only, and even that's not a guarantee, but that is really the only way you would know. Because no one's going to tell you, you know, if I got in trouble, this is purely an economic nexus, and I would tell on you in a heartbeat. No one would say that. Nobody would mess with that guy. Everyone swears up and down that they're stand up. Everyone rats, but not me. I know the code. I'm a G. I'll protect everyone, whatever. And it's a completely different tune once they go into court and people start talking about years.
Right.
But you want to know, but to double back, you want to know, and that's why I'm to some extent even more beloved now, not trying to jack myself off or whatever, is the fact that I refuse to talk in any way, shape, or form. I ate my nickel, or I'm about to go eat my nickel like a fucking man, which 99% of people won't do anymore. It's so funny that the game has deteriorated to this point from like the times when you were younger in the streets or whatever, that literally I have become a minor celebrity because I refuse to rap. Whereas before it was the given. Before Henry Hill became a celebrity because he did fucking rap. I mean, fuck him, he's a piece of shit. But it was so rare that someone would break a code of silence in any organization, Italian, Jewish, Irish, whatever, that in itself was oh my God, put this guy in the fucking paper. Now it's like people are like, holy shit, this guy didn't tell on anyone. Like lawyers are literally like, I haven't seen that in 15 years. Who the hell is this guy?
Yeah, right. You got to go back to, like, I mean, Sammy the Bull also became a celebrity off of that. Same kind of thing.
Same kind of thing. Whereas now, honestly, you actually would have to do research to be like, okay, who are the rats?
Exactly. And that's the other thing is that, you know, at this point, they've gotten better at it, right? Where they let these guys go out there and still play a bit, and you got guys that are snitching on you on a daily, not just when they get the charges thrown in front of them. So it's a whole other thing. Look, we're almost out of time in the hour. You want to go over a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
Okay, right. So what happened was, the way that this all went down was, there was a mill town outside of Pittsburgh, the kind I described, that are really economically disadvantaged because the steel industry left overnight 40 years ago, and they've never come back to their footing. They all basically look like Gary, Indiana, on a, if you need a reference or something like that, like the, you know, the worst parts of Jersey, of Camden.
Camden was.
And this town is called Braddock, PA. And there was a gang in Braddock called the SCO Gang. It was named after General Scott's high school, I think. And these guys were a vertically integrated street gang, and they sold fentanyl, bagged up heroin, crack cocaine, powder cocaine, pills, weed, too. But weed was probably their sixth option. They had a lot of other shit people were more interested in. But everyone, as you said, weed's the ubiquity of weed in the underworld is everyone sells weed. You know what I mean? You're going to have other shit, but you're always going to have weed.
Right.
So these guys were subject to a real serious, like the show The Wire style investigation with wiretaps, paid informants, police surveillance, poll cams, their cell phones being tracked by, you know, IMEI codes so they could find where they were moving at all times of day and night. And they got Title III wiretap intercepts up on them because these small towns, they have really small police departments with two cars. So these guys get outrun and outgunned by these organized crews who are serious individuals who also are, they play for keeps, they play by the code of the streets. They don't, most of them don't rat at all. They don't fuck around. These are tough guys.
Right.
So they're serious. So the cops, you know, a two-car police department in a 2,000-person town, if there's 30 of these guys, what the fuck are they going to do? So they tap the feds, and the feds come in, and they set up on these guys. So that's what they did. So I had no idea these people existed in the spring of 2019. I was doing my thing in the city in Squirrel Hill and on the east side. That's where I operated out of. These guys had a wiretap on them. A guy sold them a bunch of drugs, but he also primarily sold them weed. So the guy who sold this gang weed, he gets his phone wiretapped because he's talking into their wiretap. So that guy who sold the gang weed, follow the bouncing ball, he buys weed off another guy. The guy he buys weed off of, they never tap his phone, but he never throws his burner away. So he's just blithely talking into wiretaps for weeks on end about selling, you know, dozens, 100 pounds, you know, good amount of weed to this guy. That guy buys weed off of us in Squirrel Hill. So the feds literally follow the breadcrumbs in the river, down the river, literally just hug the river, follow the breadcrumbs all the way back into the city, and they set up shop on us. I was up there that day because there's a discrepancy in the count, because when you're sending half a ticket in cash out a week, that's half a mil, you know, it's, and you're collecting from so many different people, like you said, the, you know, that constant hustle, like in Asbury, we have to go to every meat market, laundromat, butcher shop, pizzeria, whatever, hot dog stand to go collect and put it all together. It gets hard. It gets hard to track because it's all analog. There's so many hands touching it. So whether it was through larceny or unintentionally, the money was always a little bit off. Nothing crazy, but a couple $1,000s. But our profit margins, as I previously stated, were next to nothing.
Yeah, at that level. Yeah, but at that level, yeah. Honestly, a couple $1,000s, you're not screaming about it. You're like, okay, I got to track this down. That's all there is to it. But you know you're going to have a little bit of leakage anyway. It's just going to happen.
Yeah, you have some leakage, but at $100 a pound, $4,000 is 40 pounds evaporated.
Right.
It's actually a lot of money. It's a little bit of money that adds up to a lot of money. $4,000 times 52 is 200 grand.
Well, that's why I said you got to track it down.
You have to stop it. You have to reconcile your books.
Right.
You can't just be over, under, under, over, over, under, under, over. So I was there that day to try and do so, and I didn't realize that I walked right into FBI surveillance. So we were all under surveillance. There were blacked out cars up and down the block. So they let us do the drop. They let the weed come in. They filmed us in front, kind of standing around. Again, it looked like mob surveillance. We're all standing in the middle of the day with like our hands on our hips, like talking shit. But like you see guys in front of a club or something, like social club.
Right.
Talking. Then everyone like shakes hands, hugs each other, you know, gives each other like a little, you know, lovey man, you know, and then we all they leave and I go back into the spot because they have to stage the place. They have to stack all the pounds up on the walls and put signs above them as to what type and kind they are and how much they are,
right,
what quantity. And it would just be kind of like wholesale, like a restaurant depot where guys would just come in and keep buy until it was gone. And they're all staggered kind of rolling around the neighborhood in a kind of weird air traffic control that we're controlling off of purpose zones. So the driver gets pulled over right as they leave the neighborhood. I get word the driver gets pulled over. I go running back into the place. I tell the guys the driver got pulled over and we got to get the fuck out of here right now. They kind of almost shut down in the panic and we get into an argument and I'm saying that we have to rebag everything up and leave, but it's also not even realistic what I want to do because there's three people and there's over 4 pounds. So we're in a tight spot and the driver didn't get pulled over halfway across the state of Pennsylvania or on some highway in another state. They got pulled over 7 blocks from where we're standing. So I know that a raid is inbound. I don't know about the SCO gang. I don't know about the feds. I don't know how bad my life is about to get, but I do know that a raid is coming. A raid is inbound and that it's going to happen. I was a lawyer. I've been on the street my whole life. I can put two and two together that this isn't going to be one where they show up the next day or 3 days later.
Like, nah, you got like 20 minutes tops, even if it's local PD getting a tip.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah, I got you. Okay.
Yep. So the state of panic is total, palpable. I mean, your heart is beating, the blood is coming out of your extremities, it's all pooling in your gut, your fucking balls have shriveled up into your chest, basically. You can barely breathe, and you got to make decisions immediately that are going to impact literally the rest of your life. And one wrong misstep, one false move, and you're done. I mean, you could get shot in the middle of the street by the cops, or you're going to get caught red-handed. You don't know what the fuck to do. But you do know that you have to make decisions immediately, and that's it. So eventually, they basically told me, okay, one of us is going to leave who has a car. The guy who has the place and his name is going to stay, and you get the fuck out of here. And I didn't want to because they were my guys and I felt responsibility, but they told me to leave. So I eventually gave up and I left. I walked across the street very casually because I inferred correctly that I was under surveillance, and I was. And the whole time I got two phones out communicating manically with people trying to tell everyone not to show up to the place, that it's all bad. I'm trying to wave every plane that's trying to land on this proverbial carrier's deck. All, like, better to ditch in the fucking ocean. Do not land here. You're going to die. So I get to the top of the steps, and then I run for my fucking life as fast as I can. And this is the neighborhood I grew up in, so I know where to go. I've been running from the cops here since I was literally 13, 14 years old, maybe even younger, 12. I knew where I was going. So I had to make it to a park that was about a quarter mile, half mile. I don't know. It was close enough, no more than a mile, which in Pittsburgh isn't really that long. Anyways, so I ran as fast as I could. I dipped, I ducked, I evaded, and I made it through the FBI cordon, which I didn't see at that point. But they didn't get me. I think I just took off, and I was so far away by the time I took off that I was able to do it, and then I was able to break the line of sight that they had on me. And I crashed through the trees, fall down the side of the hill. I'm trying to get to where the car is pulled over, a vantage point where I can see it on the parkway. And I get a phone call from the apartment, and it was kind of like that scene in The Departed where he's like, tell your mother you won't be home for dinner, Like, so I pick up the phone, and I'm like, hello? And the voice from the apartment goes, they're here. So I know at that point that we're completely fucked. I'm like, I'll bail you out. I'll get you out of this. And then I just hear, see ya, and the line cuts. So right. I'm completely just, like, gone. I make it home to my wife. We go on the run inside the city, basically, while I'm trying to set up a mobile command center. I bail everybody out. I see that it's a federal search warrant. I'm like, we're completely fucked. 3 weeks later, the case gets indicted. All those guys from Braddock get indicted. So do the guys who left that day. Everyone but me got indicted from the place that day, and two other guys, one of whom got indicted with me 2.5 years later. And then people start flipping.
Yeah, well, then the real bad time comes because, you could get a whole bunch of people out of that situation if nobody says anything. Not everybody gets to walk, but you could get a lot of people out. And then you got people starting to flip. You don't know necessarily.
Well, yeah, exactly. It could have been limited to the people who got hit that day.
Right.
If no one had spoken. But what happens is people flip because the feds have those mandatory minimum sentences, which came into effect in the 80s and the 90s, especially with the 1994 crime bill, where they're swinging 5 to 40s at you for 100 kilogram weed conspiracies. So everyone, I mean, that's what I ate. I got my best case scenario, and I had to eat a nickel in the feds for my first arrest, I mean, right. Which is fucking insane.
Well, and that's so, the other thing is that some of you guys might have had some records, which would have made it worse. You know, and that's the other thing. Like you're taking your first real pinch on this. They're not necessarily, because they might have had some other things going on. So they wave it at him and go, yeah. Look, you got a bad record.
And the other one is, I never carried weapons on purpose because I knew that, honestly, in this era of surveillance and snitching, that weapons are a liability. Whereas anyone else who, it doesn't matter if you got caught with a weapon on you that day, and it doesn't matter if it was a legal weapon or not, anyone that a snitch can tie to having a weapon on them while they were hustling, that's a 924C firearm murder, so the drug trafficking crime enhancement, which is a mandatory 5 on top. So right. Anybody that had a gun on or around them, or anyone that had a weapon, that even a rack to attribute a weapon to credibly, they're getting doubled up out of the gate. So it could be their first rodeo as well, but they're looking at 10 now.
Right. I'm just saying there's a variety of circumstances here that they try and leverage these guys with.
There's a multiplicity of ways that they can fuck you. The feds have had 40 years of the laws only going their way structurally, where it's only their discretion, and they can enhance you in a million different ways. The enhancements are they're not done by a jury. They're done by the prosecutors. Fighting them is virtually impossible. It's prosecutorial discretion for them. So they just basically treat you like a Jenga tower. They just keep like tick, tick, ticking enhancements out. Pull every enhancement in is a piece pulled out until the tower falls. They just keep, or it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. Well, they'll dump a barn full of straw on that camel. They have a million different ways that they could turn 5 into 80 if they feel like it, and they often do.
Right.
So people go dark. People start doing the traditional things you would see. They start firing counsel. They start falling out of contact. My wife and I they followed. Now, I quit at that point. I was like, okay, this is enough. I'm done. Because I knew what I had over my head, which was the commercial. I knew that once these rats told the cops who I actually was, even though it was 8 years later or 7 years later, that this was going to come back on me in a vicious way. So I went to ground, and I just tried to move on with my life. It got really, really bad. There's cameras outside our house. My phones, I'm almost entirely sure, have. There's rats calling me up to reminisce with me about things we did before, asking me questions. So obvious. Like, why would you call me? Like, I am the last. Like, if you sell drugs, if you sold weed in Pittsburgh in the summer of 2019, you would not want to call me if I offered you money to call me. You'd be like, I am staying the fuck away from that dude. Like, that dude got nuked. All of a sudden, guys are calling me. Hey, man, how's it going? You know how the fuck it's going. It's not going well. I think I'm going to get indicted any day. How can I help you? Oh, I was just thinking, about everything. How you work, really. You're just, like in the bathtub, like a girl eating bonbons, just thinking about weed we sold like a couple years ago. How interesting. That's happening. It's really, really bad. Then one of the guys from the apartment, who is my best friend's dad, he kills himself. Because he was a guy who was only tangentially involved in the entire operation. He just unloaded truck. He wasn't a big dog. He wasn't, a guy who was in control of any territory or any large book of business or neighborhood customers. He was a dude that was just there at the behest, not even of me, of other people who were in charge of unloading shit to help them out here and there and just basically kick it. And he has a 5 to 40 he's looking at now. And he's in his 60s. He's an old man. Right. He's almost a senior citizen. He has grandchildren, and he has a 5 to 40. He snaps. He doesn't want to tell anybody. He doesn't want to go to fucking prison. He kills himself.
Yeah.
So now my best friend tells me this. I'm vomiting in a Target parking lot when I hear this. I want to die because I see where this is going. I can see how bad this is going to get and the level of pressure they are putting on people. And I know two things. I know that more of my friends are going to suffer in this, and I also know that there's almost no way they're not going to get me because they know who the fuck I am now, and they're on a mission.
Right.
So I reach out to them through my attorneys, and I ask them if there's any way I can just turn myself in on the same charges. So this is the 100 kilogram conspiracy, 5-year mandatory minimum. I'll waive indictment, plead out as soon as I come in, get sentenced, and then go to prison in a few months and get this shit the fuck over with.
Right.
And they say that they're not interested in that, and the only thing I can do is tell.
Wow.
So I say, go fuck yourselves. I'm not telling on anybody. I'm not doing shit. I'm not putting anyone else in jail. I also got a hold of a memo that said a superseding indictment was coming with up to 10 new defendants. And I knew what that was. Those were going to be myself. I was going to be in it, but clearly a bunch of my other friends who had not been an issue previously were in it. And I think that they were just completely convinced that I was going to fold, because mathematically it's a, you know, it's a, that's like saying someone's not going to fold. It's like saying someone's going to miss an extra point. You know, it just doesn't really happen that much. Yeah. So they needed me to buttress that indictment. I would do it. So I killed their superseding indictment. So those guys all walked. They never got charged.
Right.
And I'm just kind of drifting in misery. COVID happens. So now we have to deal with all the bullshit of COVID on top of the fact that we're waiting for our door to get kicked in. But then enough time passes that we actually get hopeful. And even my lawyers are, because now we're over a year out, a year and a half out, coming up on 2 years out. Biden's running for president. He gets elected. He promises that he's not going to prosecute anyone else for weed federally, and that he's going to free the cannabis prisoners. He said no one should be in jail for this anymore. The record should be expunged, completely wiped out.
Right.
So everyone who knew what was going on with me at the time, they were like, okay, we're going to vote for Biden, even though honestly Biden was way too far right for us. We're mostly Bernie people.
Right.
So we suck it up and we vote for him, thinking like, okay, I mean, you know, this is it. Finally, for once in the fucking history of this country, you know, the passage of a presidential administration fucking worked out for somebody. You know, Biden gets elected. Nothing has happened. We're going on 2 years now, 2 years plus. We decide that we want to start a family. We start the process and try to adopt a kid. And then in August of 2021, I get indicted.
Wow. So
yeah.
What it comes down to, though, now is that, I mean, you're going to go pretty soon, looks like. And, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll be gone by the second week of May.
Man. You know, and at the same time, like I said, look, and everybody holds out hope for any of these meat puppets that end up in the White House. If they get there, you know they're corrupt. And you also know they're not going to follow through on what they say. And I don't care if it's an R or a D in front of them or whoever. I mean, I felt kind of good about what Obama did on his way out the door with, you know, setting a bunch of people at least to lesser sentences, you know, and stuff like this. Because, again, cannabis is one of those things that has transitioned now, especially over the past 20 years. And you'd figure that, you know, there'd be more progress. And there has been some. But it hasn't gotten to everybody. And, man, it's just, this story really sucks. But I got to tell, I'm really appreciating you, man. I know it doesn't do you no good at the moment. You know, it's like, yeah, great, this guy appreciates me. But, you know, the fact that you're a stand-up guy, you know, again, you weren't out to hurt nobody. You were just doing this thing because, well, there was an opportunity there. And frankly, you know what? They created this opportunity in the first place. You know,
yes, they did.
With the whole, I mean, since the 1930s, forget about the time that you and I have been alive, you know, two generations before any of us, they started this nonsense. And they continue it now. You know, there's even this recent legislation they were considering about, you know, just simply decriminalizing across the board. I don't know if that could have been helpful to you. You know,
I think it would have helped me. I don't think it would have sprung me loose per se, but I think it would have allowed me to get resentenced under something that wasn't the federal mandatory,
right,
which would have been helpful. I mean, that I'll take it. You know, if I had proffered, I should have got sentenced on the guidelines instead of the mandatory. But I refused to proffer. I just wouldn't do it.
So, right.
You know, I knew that my floor was 60 months, and nothing was getting me below that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that if that got broken, right, you know, you could walk out, and I'm not saying it's good, but you could walk out in 18 months, and that's a hell of a lot better than 60. You know what I mean?
Dude, I would fucking take it, man. If they passed that act and I got resentenced, I mean, fuck a pardon, fuck any of that shit. If I could get resentenced, I would take it. But I do want to plug my thing real quick. One of my friends started a movement called No Pardons, No Votes,
okay.
And the website is pardonsnow.com. The Twitter is @pardonsnow. And it's basically for mostly Democrats, people that you know, younger Democrats, especially in pot-smoking, pot-adjacent Democrats, that the Democratic Party has relied on increasingly since the 60s, really, to be one of its voting blocks. Absolutely. Just like people of color, union workers, you know, urban women, whatever, we're also one of those blocks. And what this movement is saying is that we're not going to vote Democrat anymore until Biden issues the pardons, because to your point, they're all fucking liars, they're all corrupt, and if they can't pardon 2,800 guys from federal prison for nonviolently selling pot, then all the other stuff, climate change, women's equality in the workplace, you know, removing racism from policing, fixing the student loan situation, preserving Social Security so it's around for anyone but baby boomers, building infrastructure, just, you know, all the shit we would need, they're never going to do any of that shit. I mean, those are trillion, multi-trillion dollar fixes, whereas, you know, freeing 2,800 guys who shouldn't be in prison anyways, that 90% of the country agrees should be free, besides cops, prosecutors, judges, and Joe Biden, if they can't do that, then they were never going to do any of the other stuff, which is obviously apparent to you. I know you know it. I get it now, naive of me to ever have thought otherwise. But I'm telling anyone else who's listening to this who was a progressive guy, a liberal guy, woman, whatever, you've been fucking had. Go to pardons now, sign the pledge, stay at home, don't vote, let a fucking libertarian or Republican or Supreme or some nutball conspiracy theorist win for a cycle, punish the Democratic Party and teach them what it is. Because that's really the only way they're going to learn. The Democratic Party is a junkie. It's a vote junkie. It takes your votes, and then it comes back and it steals your proverbial, you know, laptop and pawns it. And then it comes back in a couple of years and it says it's fine. It just needs some more votes. You give it some votes, and it goes, does some other fucked up shit, drives away with your car. Comes back again, oh, I need some more votes. It never does anything for us. Right. It does stuff for older, richer Democrats, baby boomers, people who are closer to Biden's age, senior citizens, suburban white women over 50. But for the majority of people of color, and especially for people who are caught up in the criminal justice system of any color, the Democratic Party is not significantly better than the Republicans, and that's terrible to say. It's almost heresy for Democrats to hear that. They'd be like, that's not true. But, you know, the guy who's president now, the guy who helped enact the law that I got sentenced under to go to prison, even though I voted for him and encouraged hundreds, if not even over 1,000 people that I knew in Pittsburgh to switch from Bernie to him in the general, they weren't going to vote anyways, and help swing a purple swingy swing state to him. You know, he's the same guy who broke this law. He's not going to let anybody go. He doesn't care. He thinks that I should be in jail for pot. So I'm really asking people who are on that side of it, and I understand a lot of people listen to your show, they're not doctrinaire blues. They'd be like, well, I already knew this. Good. I'm glad you did. But if you know anyone who is, tell them about me. Tell them the situation and be like, you know, the same people who put me in jail, the same prosecutors who put me in jail, I would bet you $100 are Democrats. So basically, at this point, we're in a tent with the people who put us in prison politically, and it's not going to work anymore. So you can have them or you can have us. The thing is, there's a lot more people who smoke pot who vote Democrat than there are people in the criminal justice incarceration system. It's just that the Democrats support them because they have more status inside the party internally.
Well, plus there's the monetary angle. Let's be honest. The prison system is profitable. So, you know, you got all... Look.
It's certainly profitable, and corporations make money off of it. I think for the Democrats who do this, it's honestly more that a lot of the centrist Democrat pool, like the non-Bernie pool, they're all comprised of former prosecutors. So the prosecutors make up, like, they're a very strong cohort of the party. You know, they go to the meetings, they're organized. You know, I know this from being a lawyer. Lawyers hit above their weight politically. We might only be one vote, but we do a lot of stuff locally for the backbone and infrastructure of the party that gives us kind of preferential, that's both parties, Democrat and Republican.
Right.
It gives us kind of preferential treatment in the party over someone who might have more votes than us, like a group of people, or even someone who might have necessarily more money than us. Because look, like, my family's pretty privileged. If this was a matter of like writing a check or something, like they'd do it. You know, it's not that. I'm fucked. So it's really the prerogatives and perquisites of power concentrated in a pool of prosecutors for politically. And the Democrats, they court that vote the same way the Republicans do. Look, I'm not a Republican. I don't fucking like Republicans. I don't like authoritarianism. I don't like fascism. I thought Trump in January 6th was absolute bullshit. But I really hate a hypocrite more than anything. At least if you're a Republican, they'll look you in the eye and tell you that they're a straight authoritarian, you know, hardcore conservative. I don't agree with any of that shit, but I know where I stand. I cannot stand these Democrats who stand up and, you know, rail against police brutality and rail against mass incarceration, and then they won't take a fucking stand on this shit when they vote for it, or won't vote for it.
Well, yeah, and then when you take a look at who the vice president is and you look at her history, I mean, what do you expect? That is the party.
Well, yeah, she's the poster child for it.
Yeah.
She'll go on Charlamagne Tha God's radio show, like a hip-hop radio show, and pander to people talking about how she smoked pot and she's cool. And meanwhile, like you said, she was the architect of hundreds, if not thousands, of pot convictions in California. She made us think that she had grown and matured and moved on. She hasn't said a fucking word, even though she's from the state that is the, you know, California is the pot, what Medellin, Colombia is the coke. You know, she's from the place where everyone does this. The most pot-centric, pot-concentrated, pot-business-heavy place in the entire world, not just America. And she still won't say a word about this shit.
No, exactly.
So you're right.
Listen, do me a favor and make sure, because I know you and I are in email contact, send me the exact links. And if you want a note that I can put out written along with the show, I'll put it in the show notes to direct people to that website to go and sign up, sign the pledge, do all that. Because, look, I'm not on the left or the right. I got to be honest with you. I'm sick of the whole thing. You know, but frankly, I'm with you on this. Get what it is that you're supposed to get out of it. You're supposed to be represented by these people, not told what to do by them. So, you know,
exactly. And that's and you know, I'm 40 years old, and from my generation and younger, you know, Democrats from 20 to 40, we have never, the only one who even tried to was Bernie, and they, you know, and they forced him out. They froze him out because he would have pardoned me, and he was, for many reasons, not just criminal justice and pot, he was too much of a threat to the established order. You know, he wasn't going to make nice with large corporations and cops and prosecutors and judges and other congressmen or whatever. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head. They take our votes because they need us to win. If we didn't vote, they would not win. And then they deliver us nothing. They just tell us what to do.
Exactly. And they, you know, they kneecapped him. Out of all the guys that ran in 2016, I'll tell you what, if I was to cast a vote for any of them, I probably would have went for him. And I know that sounds crazy to a lot of people that listen to me, because some people, you know, if you're on the left, you often think I'm on the right. If you're on the right, you often think I'm on the left. I'm one of those guys, right? But honestly, the only guy who had a message that made any kind of sense, the only guy who had the wherewithal to make the right statements, and I actually believed that if he had been granted that power, he would have enacted them, is Sanders. He was the only honest broker. In my mind, and I don't like his foreign policy. I don't like a bunch of stuff about him. But I tell you what, you know, put a gun to my head, this is the guy I vote for. Because at least there would have been change. Okay? And what we got, you know, well, we know what we got. But, you know, we've gotten two very large disappointments if you were looking for anything like change, in my mind. And, you know, here is where we stand, but... sadly, I mean, this is kind of where your story comes to an end, but I'm thinking to myself, I got to ask a question here, and I know I've kept you extra time tonight, and I appreciate you taking the time, but I got to ask a serious question, because look, you're legally trained, you're capable, you're obviously intelligent, not just, you know, street intelligence, but you know the legal system. Is there any way possible that you're going to be able to work something out? I mean, obviously, you're going to go in. You're going to eat some time. That's for sure. But, I mean, is there any sort of possibility, a way to get you out sooner, something like this? I mean, I'm thinking that you're exactly the guy who could find it. And I've known more than one jailhouse lawyer, you know what I mean? So I'm thinking that you're the guy who can figure that out. You might not want to talk about it if you have something in hand. But,
I can tell you briefly. So basically, my chance to get out earlier than that, it really resides. It's at the discretion of the people who work, you know, in the prison. Basically, it's in the discretion of the BOP.
there are certain programs that I can take if I get admitted to and they think that I'm completing them honestly and successfully, that I can get so a little bit of time knocked off, like a year max. And then there's, you know, halfway house placement time, and there's some first step back credit time. You know, there are things that I can do, I can avail myself, but I can't really assume any of that, because that would be the height of arrogance, because I'm simply not the one making the determination. I could go in there and, you know, not cause any problems, which I wasn't trying to do, and just do what I needed to do and, you know, keep my head down, and try and enroll and complete as many of the programs as directed. But right. The rest of that's on them. In terms of some legal eagle maneuver, literally the only thing that gets me out that way is an act of Congress or a pardon from Joe Biden. That's it.
So, well, I guess the governor can't do anything about it because it's federal.
No, he has no jurisdiction over me. If this had been a state case, I probably would have gotten like a year and done about 8 or 9 months.
Right. So you literally need a federal pardon, and that's the president,
yep.
Effectively.
Yep.
Or
I literally need the king to pardon me. Otherwise, I have to, you know, there's certain programs that I will do my absolute best to avail myself of.
Right.
But I'm not going to speak arrogantly and, you know, speak from the mindset, because I haven't been a criminal in a long time. You know, like, right. I'm not going to speak from the mindset of someone who's a criminal and be like, oh, yeah, man, I got this covered, because I'm not going to try and be slick. I don't know. I got to go in there humble and do my best to get the fuck out, which means, you know, I'll comply to the programs and work them as best I can. But that's their discretion, you know,
right.
Not mine.
Right. Well, and the other thing is, you mentioned an act of Congress, but, you know, unfortunately, as we've learned over the past few years, even if there is a change in what the Congress decides, then you got to go and relitigate that anyway. You got to revisit it, and there's no guarantee of success, especially given, as you said, you might end up facing people who are already familiar with you, got a bad taste in their mouth from you already. Not saying that, you know, not saying they should. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying, look, you know you're going to go in there with a lot of baggage. So trying to get sympathy out of some of those people that you might end up drawing, that's not going to go so well. But I mean, I'm sure you're going to take a shot at that too, if per se there is a significant change in the federal statutes or laws, and those are two different things, that could provide you some relief. I'm sure you're going to try, and you're going to go in, you're going to comply, you know, you're going to try and do good time, which is always helpful no matter what. You know, and I feel terribly for you, man. It's I mean, again, I appreciate the balls and the brains here, but sadly, you know what it is? It's some guy you don't even know that causes a cross-contamination in investigations that drew you into the bad spot you're in right now. And then on top of
someone I didn't know caused the cross-contamination. You know, what's funny, though, is honestly, there are some guys I've come across in this case that I didn't know in the case until we all got charged. And those guys are actually some of the coolest motherfuckers I've talked to. They're actually really stand-up guys, and they're cool guys.
Right.
You know, I didn't do what they did, per se, but, like, who am I to judge? You know, we're all federal cons. And you know, right. As long as you're a stand-up guy and you're not out here there to hurt anybody, then, you know, you have my respect. The thing that kills you in this game is that, and it's just like, you know, it's whether someone fries you up and serves you to the feds, or whether someone shoots you in the back of the fucking head one night in a car when you're going over money or talking or whatever. It's always your friends. You know, I mean, that's one thing about the underworld, the organized stuff or whatever, is it's always your friends who do you, because your enemies don't know. They don't know enough about you to.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, and it's an odd example I'm going to present to you real fast, but I'm sure you know about Michael Franzese and, you know, how he went down. The one thing that I'll say about him is, you know, because, first of all, he was kind of went into it with privilege. You know, he had his father ahead of him there and all that. But when it came down to it, as far as I know, Franzese never gave up anybody else. You know, he just went and did his time and took his. And I don't know. I got some respect for him. I know he does weird stuff nowadays. He's got like a mentoring program where he's like, you know, the Jesus saved me gangster and all that. It's kind of funny nowadays. But honestly, when he went down, He just said, no, I'm going to take my time. And no, I'm not putting anybody else behind this. Which is exactly the same thing that you're doing. So, you know, I don't know. I got respect for that because, look, you take the weight for what you do. And you knew that going in, that was a possibility. But when you turn around and you start caging up other people, you know, that's where, quite honestly, I don't feel bad when somebody goes down, you know, inside. Because, you know what, this is what you get.
You're not a man when you do that anymore. Right. I don't think you could ever really like wake up in the mirror and brush your teeth and look in the mirror and see a man looking back at you. When you put anyone in prison, but you know, triple extra, especially special ring of hell for people who put people who love them and who that they said they loved in prison.
Right.
I mean, that is. I mean, you're just a fucking worm. You're not a man.
Exactly. No, but that's what I'm saying is I really, and that's another thing I wanted to say, you know, straight, is that I do respect you on that, and that's the way you're going. I understand that it's going to be tough, I'll tell you this, I know it doesn't do you no good, and it probably isn't going to make you feel any better, but, you know, definitely going to pray for you, and if there's anything that I mean, look, if I had, money's not the problem, good thing, because I don't got none, but if there's anything that can be done, you know, by all means, let me know personally. Even I would try to help you if there's something that can be done there. But unfortunately, like you said, there's just only a few options to try and get things rolling. And you're going to need a little bit of luck. You're going to need a little bit of charm, probably. You're going to have to make some new friends, and you're going to have to do it while standing up, which is not the easiest thing to do. You know, rats do get some benefits. That's why they're rats. I appreciate what it is you're doing, your mentality, what can I say, man? Starting with that commercial, I know you regret it now, on some level, but it's, brother, you're a brilliant guy. So, look, you're 10 years younger than me. You know, if you got to eat the whole nickel, look, you get out at, you know, 45, 46, right? You'll be all right. And I feel good that you're going to be all right, and I definitely want to hear from you again if I'm still breathing when you get back out. Okay?
For sure. I'll be happy to do a follow-up whenever it is my feet touch Pittsburgh ground again.
Yeah, I mean, look, even if you have the ability, if nobody bans you from doing media, because that's another thing they might do to you, by the way, conditions when you come out of the halfway house or whatever. They turn around, they tell you can't do any media, stuff like this. That might happen. I mean, I'm sure you're going to stick by the stipulations if they're tied to your freedom or even relative freedom based on the situation. But I'm just saying, if I'm still around, definitely let me know what's going on with you or have somebody let me know. And also make sure to email me that stuff so I can literally copy and paste it into the show notes that'll travel with this because the podcast listenership is a lot larger than the live listenership, and I'd like people to be first aware of your story, learn from it, and get a little more outraged, because here we go. Did you hear any violence in his story, in Daniel's story? Anybody? Did you? I didn't. This is a nonviolent criminal, right? And a criminal, I'm calling him that because that's what they're calling him. But to me, this is a businessman who, you know, what did he do? He met a need. He met a need that, quite frankly, yeah, the laws are against it, but who did he hurt? I mean, in all seriousness, who did he hurt? This is the guy who's got to go to prison? Anyway, Daniel, I'm sorry. I know I'm saying these things. I'm sure you heard them 100 times. And, you know, again, special ring of hell for these idiots who are calling you up. Hey, let's talk about the old days when we were able to move 500 pounds. And, yeah, you're cute. So what is it they're pushing up against you? And I understand when they're sitting there and waving, like you talked about your friend's father. Look, the guy's 60, and they're waving 40 at him, whether he could realistically do it or not. Listen, anybody can do that math. You're not coming out of prison alive. So, you know, I'm not saying that I agree with his choice. I'm just saying that I understand it. As horrible as that is, But this is what the system will do to you if you just, you know, kick over the wrong rock. It's not even about how many people get hurt or nothing. It's just about, well, you violated the wrong thing. And the fact is that, to my mind, cannabis stuff is all about the taxes anyway. You know, that, yeah, that's the realistic thing, is that they're not able to collect the same taxes on you. You know, what did they get Capone for, even? Tax evasion. I mean, come on. This is what this is really about, is they're not in on your revenue stream. Okay? I mean, and as far as smoking weed, give me a break. Who does anybody know who's listening to me right now that doesn't smoke some weed, that hasn't smoked some weed? I mean, give me a break, man. And, you know, a whole lot more people are dying every single year from perfectly legal things like alcohol. I mean, but that's okay, because you know what? There's plenty of taxes on it. It's okay. No, it's not. Right. And this needs to change. So, Daniel, anything that you want to say? Like I said, I apologize for taking you over time, but I wanted you to get all the way through your story. And it is one that people need to hear. And I'm really grateful, again, to J.G. Michael for putting me in contact with you. Of course, he's, you know, sort of local to you. I'm sitting in Georgia nowadays because it's cheaper to live here, and trying myself to stay out of trouble. But it is what it is. And I really wish there was something that we could do about this right away. And who knows? Maybe we'll get lucky and there'll be enough of an outcry if enough people are taken out of their neighborhoods, not just people of color who have been overwhelmingly punished excessively for stuff like this. But it doesn't matter. You know, if you're a monetized commodity, you're worth money to the prison industrial complex. You're worth money to those people that make their living prosecuting. You're worth money. So, you know, they will ring up the register on you, and it doesn't matter what color. I mean, I know all the money in America is green, but trust me, when it comes from other parts of the world, it's made up of many other colors, and they also don't care what God you pray to. Although I do love that part of your video where you spin the dreidel and you go, "Hey, I'm Jewish." I find that hilarious. So anyway, and I'm also going to give you guys the links to the video itself, which has survived out there despite the fact that you tried to pull it back. There might be some news reports. You were interviewed on some local TV, I think. Some other links I might have, and the stuff that you're going to provide me. But meanwhile, I just want to give you a chance to say whatever it is you want, and then we'll close this out. And again, I know it's going to wind up about 40 minutes over the time I asked for, but I really appreciate you taking the time with me today, man.
I appreciate it, too. I really appreciate you listening to my story, trying to hear what's going on, spreading the truth to the people. And I'll send you all the relevant links and whatnot. And I just want anyone listening to remember my name and remember it's not just about me. There's 2,800 nonviolent cannabis offenders right now in federal prison. I'm no better or worse than any of them. There's a lot of men in there who are doing life right now. Guys doing 22 years. Luke Scarmazzo is doing 22 for owning pot shops in Modesto. My friend Bobby Capelli, he got caught with a Cessna in New Haven. He's doing 8 years. You know, as nuts as my sentence is, if you do a little research, you'll see that I was one of the quote-unquote lucky ones. Yeah. So you should be disgusted and you should be outraged. And I know that a lot of people are so politically disaffected, which is why no pardons, no votes is effective, because we're not asking you to go campaign or donate to anyone. We're literally asking you to call up your local elected officials from dog catcher all the way up to senator and say, "Hey, fuck you. We're not standing for this shit anymore. Let these guys go or your gravy train stops. Don't care what's in front of your name."
No, and that's exactly what needs to be heard. And frankly, again, yeah, I know. I did have the tendency to think I wanted to say to you, you know what, you're actually kind of lucky in that you're, you know, it's only a nickel you're looking at. But there's no luck when it comes to going to prison. Loss of your freedom is something that's not a lucky thing. It could have been worse.
No.
Yeah, it could have been worse. But nonetheless, you might have actually saved yourself a lot of time by not cooperating, by the way, because even though they would have reduced that sentence, I mean, listen, if they're reducing 50 years, they give you 15. You know, you didn't give them anything more to work with. So there's another little lesson that, you know, I don't want to say out loud, but it's one of the first ones they ever teach you, if you have to make your way in a less than conventional sense, let's say. But anyway, Daniel Music.
Yeah. Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Thank you, Daniel Music. And again, you know what? I'm going to give you guys all these links and everything in the show notes, and I'm going to take a break here and get back to you with a little bit of news with the rest of the show. But this was a story that needed to be told, and I hope that you guys are learning something from it, are going to take some action, because this is the kind of thing that needs to be changed, and not 10 years from now, not the next time somebody's elected, right now. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Nibiru, also known as Planet X, was going to get within the gravitational pull of the Earth and cause mass commotion and chaos?
More that. More commotion. More confusion. It goes into the confusion thing. Hey, going nut, he's going back, and it's going crazy.
I hate being confused like that.
But that's exactly how he wants it.
It is, but at the Ocelli.com radio network, you're never confused.
No, it's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
It's about time. Forget this Nibiru stuff and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
.com, and he'd get it right where you want to hear it at. Right straight ahead instead of ding-donging back and forth here.
Ocelli.com.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper.
What are people saying about MyTrueEssence.net?
I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell you listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christie, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles started to really be pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. Essential oils rule!
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're tuned into The Ocelli Effect.
When a fan of The Ocelli Effect calls in to The Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JP Sicily and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have okay. No idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Ocelli.com.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Normally, I would say this is the second hour of the Ocelli Effect, but it is not. It is actually much later in the hour, and we've got about 15 minutes left. So, I'm going to step away and kill the air conditioner because I can hear it way too loud into my monitor. Okay. So, now that we've done that, let's get down to it. I had a news sort of recap that I was going to go over. And I'll just flip through my notes fast because 45 less minutes than I thought I'd have. But the Daniel Music story, the Better Call Saul guy, basically, I love him. I mean, it's sad and sick that anybody's going to prison, federal prison, for cannabis in this day and age, especially, but ever, honestly. So let's get down to it. I know half of you have already smoked a joint in the time that I've been doing this show, and whether you're listening to me on podcast or not. So anyway, let's get to it. What did I see scanning through the news feeds today? Well, unfortunately, I got sucked into Facebook for a minute, and I watched Lee Camp. God help me. Sitting there, and, well, you know, he's a little upset about being, knocked out of his job at RT and all that. But his thrust today was actually about the drug war. Same kind of thing about cannabis and the nature of legalizing it and all that. And he did a Facebook Live and blah, blah, blah. And, I'm looking at him and I'm wondering, why are you doing this today? I guess he's looking for sympathetic ears and Patreons. So is what it is. Addy Ads also was at it today, and he was doing some stuff, some reporting on the violence in Central and South America as related to, guess what? The drug war. Seems as though people are coming back around to this because the predatory system has continued to punish people for absolutely non-violent offenses constantly. So, after a while, I guess everybody turns around on it. So Addy Ads will be on the show, I think Wednesday, and we'll be talking to him probably about this because he's getting ready to make a trip out west and do some reporting on the current status of the drug war. So what else did I happen to do? Oh, by the way, let's tell you about a couple other things that are coming up this week. I think Mike Swanson will be with us on Thursday, which is also my birthday, but I'll be producing Jack Blood's show before my show again. So 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, you'll get the Jack Blood Show as it stands at Ocelli.com. Also in the 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, but on Wednesday slot, Donald Jeffries. I have no idea what he has planned, but I guess we'll see. So that's what's coming up for the week as far as other shows. Mike should be with us on Thursday. I guess the guys from the Failed State Update are due up again because Larry Hancock was with us last week on Thursday. We'll see how that goes. But then again, I don't know. If I get real, real lucky, Maybe I'll take the night off and buy myself a burger if I can afford it. But as you well know, it's been a tough haul lately. Anyways, let's see, who else have we got coming up? Well, Christy Aphrodite will be on tomorrow night. She's in my chat room right now, so we're going to get some more information on healthy things one way or another in the second hour tomorrow night. And in the first hour, I'm going to have Sam Idolette back on to talk about his very interesting self-exploration in his book. And I believe, you know what, I don't want to mess up the title of his book, but Sam Idolette's an interesting author. And he's got an interesting philosophical book out there, and I'm going to discuss it with him again. The guy who called me the cranky Italian, right? Anyways, I decided to scan and take a look at the more extreme ends of the corporate media pool. And what does America Reports have to say on Fox News while I was randomly scanning? Well, you know, they're all up in arms about the Disney and the education bill in Florida and how that's affecting people. And, you know, the different GOP states are trying to sue the Biden administration because they're ending Title 42 regarding immigration, which, by the way, ties us back to the drug war again, because that's usually the key points. When Addy was reporting on it earlier today, by the way, he was focusing on what's going on in El Salvador, because I think we're looking at yet again another killing field there, and the crackdowns, which have been issued, you know, much like Duarte over there in the Philippines. You got them because of the narco status of the society. There is a reaction there, and one does have to wonder when they're saying that out loud they're only going to feed these people once a day, and they don't care. The crime is out of control. Violence is out of control. I mean, you know, are you going to appreciate it when they bring this to the different places here where they say it's completely out of control, despite what the reality may or may not be? Keep that in mind, because remember what they beta test elsewhere among poor people, they will bring to our poor people next, and then to everybody. Sort of like heroin, except they, you know, it was okay when it was among poor people, but once, you know, white America got a hold of all those prescription pills, end game. Of course, that was super profitable for the corporations, so pay no attention to any of that. All right, so back to it. What else did we see there? Okay, so we have polls and prices and what's going on with the gas, and this is what Fox decided to go to, right? And their complete misrepresentation of what's what. And oh, by the way, you know, worry about the fact that the guy in New York City who's about to run that city completely into the ground, you know, put a cop in charge, see what happens. Yeah, you're gonna. Apparently, he's rather worried about toddlers wearing masks in public and all that. Then you have the obligatory mentions of Stacey Abrams and Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton did Sunday shows. Why the hell this woman does not just go away, I do not know. But anyway, the left and its usual, you know, maniacal obsession. This is a quote. Maniacal obsession with putting cloth over the mouths of kids' faces. Okay, so that's what they said over there. Kayleigh McInerney did a whole little rant on it. And polls, polls, polls. That's the way it is. All right, fine. Culture wars. Don't say gay law. Oh, that's right. I went over to MSNBC, and there, instead of talking about the education bill in Florida, it's the don't say gay law. And what is the big mouse going to do? That corporation that is a big job creator. You know, I thought these people were always supposed to be on the sides of the job creators in the state of Florida. All right. Is what it is, and all that being interrupted by what? Well, there was the DeSantis and Matt Gaetz are apparently, you know, standing with the whole thing about don't mention gay stuff in the classroom, blah, blah, blah. The White House decided to do a briefing regarding, this is what interrupted everything today. On the streams, the White House gave a briefing, not by Jen Psaki, but initially they gave us, Jake Sullivan from the Pentagon. No, he wasn't from the Pentagon. The Pentagon briefing followed that. But they gave us his assessment and the whole thing about the war crimes and how guilty Russia is. I mean, pay no attention that America probably committed 80 war crimes before the Russians got out of bed. That used to be a slogan for something, didn't it? Anyway, So we went through all that, the reporting on all of who's who in the Russian oligarch world, and then Jen Psaki interrupted him. So it is what it is. What was another big story today? Tesla, okay, your friend Elon Musk, everybody loves Elon, right? Making a major purchase, buying himself up 9% of Twitter, which gives him the largest stake in the company held in private. So what does that mean? I have no idea. I hope you guys do, because what are you supposed to do? And of course, Tesla and Twitter, both under their, you know, TSLA and under their TWTR stock market labels, they both did well over the past few days. Twitter actually going up by about 28% by the closing of the day today. Now, I only saw the live right at the close, so maybe they recalculated at the end, but let's just say it went up 25% today, easily, based on the fact that Elon Musk bought it. I don't know what to make of where that's actually going. And everybody loves Elon, right? Not me. Anyhow, Starbucks is complaining because, of course, they're losing market share. They're losing money. Their stock is even falling because they stopped doing those buybacks that I keep talking with Mike Swanson about. Okay, so they stopped doing that. Gold went up a little. Silver went down a little. But basically, you got a little bit of stability out of the precious metals today, look like to me. And what else is in the news before I totally run out of time? Judge Ketanji Brown, right? Ketanji? I'm not sure. Anyway, either way, the black woman that Biden definitely said he would find a black woman to put on the Supreme Court. Well, it looks like there's a split decision there in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, but they're probably going to pass it along for a major vote. And what made headlines just before I went to air? Well, not only had Susan Collins, you know, the backbone of the backbone of the Republican Party, which has no backbone, said she was going to vote for Judge Brown. But it turns out Mitt Romney, who is not super popular among the GOP at the moment, and let's see, who was it else? And Murkowski, that's right. Murkowski is also going to vote. So if you get three GOP members to split that vote, you got a majority, because God knows what Manchin will do. And we may indeed be looking at the first black woman on the Supreme Court, who from what I can observe, is actually overqualified to be on the Supreme Court. But, you know, not according to the naysayers and not according to the people that want to ask her if babies are racist, which I don't understand that book. I don't understand the premise, nor do I understand the argument. I mean, can we not just sometimes say that some things are stupid and put them aside? Well, that's right. I'm in America. All right, I could be wrong about a lot of things, but I'll tell you what I'm not wrong about, and that is that we are still going to be facing a lot of troubles coming up here because of the economic situation, the lack of stimulation, and the reality that we currently seem to be failing in our occupation of. Seems like it's run by a whole lot of people that have no connection to the real world, and that's that. I'll tell you, that's another key thing about the music story there, is that there is a real world, there is a real America. Some of it resides in the black and gray markets, and when every once in a while you piss off the wrong person, they will drag you out of those markets, even though they rely upon them. I will never forget, interviewing Celly Castillo and asking him about, you know, the situation on the border, and we were talking about various things that come through at the port of entry, when it comes to drug traffic. And it's amazing because a whole lot of car dealerships and even banks would fold up right then and there in that part of Texas without that point of entry stuff. And no, don't convolute it with the immigration problem. Don't convolute it with this whole, you know, this delusion that people carry these things on their backs. Why do that when you can pay the guy to look the right way and you can bring in a whole tractor trailer? I mean, the only thing to fill that tractor trailer with that's probably more profitable, if you know what you're doing, is human traffic, maybe. Maybe. But human traffic's harder to maintain than drugs. And drugs is easier to replenish. You know, Some people, you traffic them the wrong way, you get them destroyed, wrecked, dinged up too much. They're not as useful. And then what are they going to do? Sell you for hamburger meat? Well, I guess that's what happens when you join the military. Anyway, that's all I got to say for today, and I hope that you guys learned something along the way. Remember this, I am Merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect, and I will be back tomorrow night, as I said, with Sam Idolette, and then the one and only Christy Aphrodite on a Tuesday Ocelli effect, but Moon Day's finished, so we'll get to Tears Day, we'll get to Woden's Day, we'll get to Thor's Day, we'll get to Friar's Day, and then no promises after that, because by the time it's Friar's Day, I'll be 50 years old, and I didn't even expect to be here this long.
The Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.